720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth. James and Ozdahl's here. We're hanging out with you. We're in for Bill and Wendy today with you till 3 o'clock. We've got a big show lined up for you.
Big show. I walked over here from Rivet, where I worked during the day. It's like a 30-minute walk. It's like spitting daggers in the air.
Little ice daggers all around.
Seriously, I crossed that bridge over the Chicago River, and it was coming at me from both ends. God forbid I take a cab.
I know. I was going to say, there are
today would be the day to do it.
Vehicles that you can hop in. I know I did that, but it took me a long time to find one.
I felt like a martyr as I was walking across the river.
There's no
reason for this.
Well, you know, be careful because I'm just now seeing people outside trying to plow sidewalks and things like that. But I've seen a couple people almost wipe out here outside of the showcase studio. So be careful. The sidewalks are slushy and slick, and I totally wore the wrong shoes. So I myself will be falling down later, I'm sure.
See, I'm wearing sensible flats. I'll be okay.
For a change.
Yes.
For a change.
Well, you know, I can't always show off my gams.
I know. People can only take so much.
Exactly.
I mean, really.
Have mercy.
Have mercy on the people. You know, it is that time of year where we, you know, lots of looking back, some self-reflection, but also we kind of look at things that have happened in the year. And I feel like that's a theme we have in the show today coming up. Lots of like, what happened this year?
Well, this is the week, right?
I mean, this is the week.
Besides the fact that people are completely phoning in their jobs this week, that stretch of time between Christmas and New Year's, people are absolutely phoning it in. This is the time when you look back on the past 12 months and think about highlights, lowlights, the things that happened.
I think it's really interesting with social media and how quickly news cycles go now. It seems there's stories that happened this year that already seem like 6 years ago.
For real.
I mean, way, 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 way. Even things that just happened a couple of months ago. Like already the Jared Fogle thing with Subway. I was kind of looking back at stories for there. I was like, that just happened.
Right.
Just happened. I already feel like it was a year ago. So
agreed.
that was a big story for sure this year. The that whole Pharma Bro thing.
Explain that.
So Martin Shkreli, hard name to say. Sounds like you're drunk when you say it. But he became CEO of Turing Pharmaceuticals, and he jacked up the price of Daraprim, which is literally a life-saving drug in many cases. It helps AIDS patients, pregnant women, cancer patients. It treats toxic plasmosis. It does really important stuff. He jacked the price up by 5,000%. So we're talking about something like $750 per pill.
Yeah, he became a villain overnight.
And he was very young anyway to be a CEO. And so I think a lot of people are already skeptical of him. But he was arrested just recently on securities fraud charges. And so he has stepped down. The charges do not relate to that, to Daraprim or Turing. It's a previous hedge fund that he managed. But nonetheless, I think people like to see people, I think particularly villains, right? They love to see the powerful and the mighty fall.
They love karma in action.
They do, totally. And that's an example. I mean, he did the perp walk with the sweatshirt, the hoodie up. I mean, in the sunglasses. It was the classic, the quintessential perp walk even. He did it. And we saw it. And there it was. So that was a big one. And then I think, you know, Facebook has been in a lot of news this year, particularly like personal and professional, right?
Well, sure.
I mean, we've seen a lot of
Zuckerberg had a kid.
He had a kid. He started that, like, I'm doing air quotes, foundation that really wasn't structured on paper to be like a 501c3. It was an LLC. So people immediately were like, oh, he's giving away 95% of his wealth in the Warren Buffett thing. Oh, no, he's not. He's getting a big tax break. When you really break it down and look at it, it actually makes kind of perfect sense. And it's reasonable what he did. But at first, I think people were quick to jump on. What a villain. What a crook.
For sure.
But then also we saw, we saw a lot of parental leave stuff happening in Silicon Valley. I feel like we talked about that a lot this year because like Netflix gave this unlimited parental leave policy where you could take as much time as you wanted off after the birth or adoption of a child.
Right.
But then we also saw other personal things like Sheryl Sandberg grieving so publicly after her husband died. And she took time off for bereavement and talked a lot about that.
Sheryl Sandberg.
Yes.
Of
Facebook.
Facebook.
Of course. You know, the lean in.
Right.
The leaning in. So, you know, it was interesting to see kind of human side of a lot of tech leaders, too.
Sure.
Other side of that, though, we have like Marissa Mayer in Yahoo, who said, no, I'm going to have twins and I'm only going to take 2 weeks off and that's all.
Yeah. You don't need to be a hero.
I mean, it's her right to do that, you know,
sure.
and she can you can do your parental leave however you want. I have to think, though, that if I worked for Yahoo and my CEO said I'm only going to take 2 weeks off following the birth of my children, I would feel inclined to follow suit. I mean, the boss sets the tone. So you can say you have unlimited parental leave all you want, but if your boss isn't doing it.
I agree.
You're not going to do it.
You don't want to be that person.
You're not going to be that guy to, I mean, it's the same with vacation, you know? Like if your boss says, well, you have unlimited vacation, take time off whenever you want, but they never take vacation and they do email on nights and weekends, you're going to do the same.
I know people who end the year with leftover vacation time. If you don't take your vacation time, the company wins.
Oh, yeah.
Don't let the company win.
The man wins. Don't give your vacation to the man. That's true.
You got to use
That's totally true. That's totally true. Of course, we saw some big, more local stories too. I mean, there's the big story that was like Chicago versus Chicago was Michael Jordan. He had that lawsuit against the two big grocery giants, Jewel and Dominick's, mm-hmm. same parent company ultimately, but they used his likeness and he sued them and won. And that was like Chicago versus Chicago versus Chicago in that courtroom. And he won, I don't remember the amount, but quite a lot of money.
I still miss my local Dominick's. They were very friendly when I went there.
But they're turning into Whole Foods left and right.
And Mariano's.
And Mariano's, mm-hmm. yeah.
Where you can get a cocktail as you walk around and
at Mariano's?
Oh, yeah.
What? What is it?
You of all people, Italy? I would expect to know this.
What does that mean, you of all? You drink and shop?
Right.
What does that mean?
They have a little bar there.
In Mariano's?
Yes.
All Mariano's?
Yeah. In fact, the carts have drink holders, so you can walk around with your pint of beer or your wine.
I'm confirming. I do this, well, I don't want to say regularly, but yes, usually.
As miserable as grocery shopping can be, especially around the holidays, this is a nice way to take the edge off, Amy Guth.
I had no idea.
Oh, yeah.
I see there's a Starbucks in my Mariano's, but I have yet to identify a bar.
Got to dig deep. Usually it's by the frozen section.
Next to the piano player.
Yeah. What's happening right now?
How do you not know this? This blows my mind that you've never heard of it.
I have no idea. I'm sort of new to the Mariano's shopping, I would say.
We should hang out more.
Yeah, I guess so. All right.
So coming up this hour, Jim DeRogatis. We'll be talking to him shortly. Jim is a rock critic. He's the author of several fine books. And he'll be talking about, as we are right now, end of the year stuff, highlights from the year, but in his case, music. I mean, really, no one better to talk to than Jim DeRogatis.
No one better.
And speaking of music, Living Color, Corey Glover from that band, Living Color's in town this week. Corey Glover will be checking in from the road and talking about that band has so much history.
I know.
Grammy Awards, on the first Lollapalooza tour. They were just here at Riot Fest a couple months ago.
Yeah. I saw them during that Lollapalooza tour. Not Riot Fest, but I saw that Lollapalooza tour.
And then in the 2 o'clock hour, Mike Gebert, I think one of the finest food writers in town, he'll be coming in to talk about the year in food and restaurants in Chicago.
Because we saw a lot. I mean, I stand by this. You know what? There is so much happening in the Chicago food world that, you know what? I would go Chicago versus New York any day. And Chicago would totally win. New York thinks it would win, but Chicago would totally win. We just have so much passion about our food here. And we have a great community of, you know, restaurants helping other restaurants and just really cool things happening here. And so I'm excited to talk about that one.
Yeah. All right. Well, we need a break, yes?
Yeah, we got to take a break. We got to do all the stuff.
We'll take a break. We'll come back with Jim DeRogatis on WGN. It's WGN. Amy Guth, that's her. I'm James Van Osdell. We're in for Bill and Wendy today. And on the phone, he's more than just a rock critic. He is a true music journalist. He's the author of several exemplary must-read books, including Milk It, Collective Musings on the Alternative Music Explosion of the 90s, Let It Blurt, The Life and Times of Lester Bangs, America's Greatest Rock Critic, and Staring at Sound, The True Story of Oklahoma's Fabulous Flaming Lips. He's an instructor at Columbia College. Most famously, he's the co-host of the syndicated show Sound Opinions. Jim DeRogatis on WGN. Hi, Jim.
I'm surprised you have any time left after that long introduction.
Well, we got to go. It's been great to hear you.
It's a pleasure. Always a pleasure. You and I go way back.
We do. We have a lot of history together. And, you know, I always love following your year-end list. And the year's over. You turned in your best of 2015 list earlier this month. Can we walk through some of it?
Sure.
Your reasons for living. 2015.
Goes back to when I was an ultra naive but super enthusiastic fanzine kid. That was my fanzine, Reasons for Living.
Nice.
Do people still do zines? Or are they all online?
A huge resurgence in zine culture. If you go over to Quimby's on North Avenue, they've got literally hundreds.
I just thought everything would move online at some point.
Zines are back. Vinyl has been back so long it's old news.
Vinyl's been back and so institutionalized now that the Columbia Record Club is coming back with vinyl in mind.
Yeah, maybe. They went bankrupt this year, actually.
Yeah. All right, so let's talk about your reasons for living. Let's start right at the top with Courtney Barnett, Australian performer. This seems like an obvious critic's choice. You know, they're Grammy considerations. Spin loves Courtney Barnett. What is it about this album? Sometimes I sit and think and sometimes I just sit.
Well, you know, I think the handful of critics, most critics have loved her. The handful who've been skeptical point out that it's a very retro 90s sound. You know, she sounds a lot like Nirvana. And it's like, well, yeah, that's like trying to sound like the Beatles or the Rolling Stones, you know. The thing is, she has that sort of charisma. She's got a wicked sense of humor, sharp irony, a really strong feminist perspective without being preachy, and those killer, really crunchy, grungy, hard-hitting guitar sounds, but combined with melody. And I think that that's what makes the Kurt Cobain comparisons valid. It's got a huge impact to it, a lot of power, but they're very melodic tunes.
Speaking of the 90s, something else on your list, the band Bully. That to me sounds like a very 90s sound, the album feels like.
Yeah, that's the other record. So it's interesting that there's two records by young women this year, you know, both coming from a strong feminist perspective, both kind of going back to the 90s. I mean, neither of these artists were born or were barely born when Nirvana and Hole were exploding. You know, and so it makes sense, you know, if you kind of look at the history of rock and roll in 20 years cycles, you know, people go back and rediscover things that were done and then update them. You know, there's been innumerable psychedelic revivals, let's say. You know, people in the mid-80s, early 90s rediscovered, you know, the Beatles' Revolver and took that as a launch pad to do new sounds. And now people are rediscovering those 90s sounds. There's a huge shoegaze revival, as you know, James.
I'm aware. It, you know, looking at the list also, Kendrick Lamar is number three on your list. To Pimp a Butterfly is your number three album.
Yep.
When you look at the whole of music, everything that's out there, everything that you want to focus on and distill down to the 40 essential releases for the year, isn't it difficult to go cross-genre? Wouldn't it just be easier to come up with a list of the 40 best rock albums? Isn't it hard? Do you feel like you have to sprinkle in, you know, an Americana album or a hip-hop album or other genres just for balance sake?
No. I mean, I think some rock critics, you know, try to do what I call critical correctness. You know, I have to have X number of women, X number of world albums or hip-hop albums. You know, and I, you know, Cott and I agree on very little. Greg Cott, you know, co-hosts Sound Opinions, works over there in that Tribune Tower for as long as you guys continue to own it. Or rent it.
Borrow.
I know. Well, you know, the Sun-Times is gone. I look at that Trump thing. It gives me agita every time. Right?
The syringe.
We go by the old Lester Bangs thing. It's like, what records do we love listening to? You know, if the house was on fire after I got my wife out, which 10 albums would I grab? And I think that this Kendrick Lamar record, now I was a skeptic. I did not like his last record. I thought there were too many sort of hip-hop cliches, in particular sort of the gangster braggadocio and the disrespect toward women. But this is a fascinating album that's, you know, one of the most interesting hip-hop or soul or R&B records I've heard since D'Angelo's Voodoo, which was a classic that's now 15 years old. You know, in terms of hopping across genres and, you know, really not worrying about genre constrictions and incorporating just fascinating musicality and great storytelling. You know, he sort of, this was in the year of Black Lives Matter, this was the soundtrack.
Interesting.
Yeah. Well, I think too, it's interesting to me, the things that pop off of this list to me are things of, you know, mostly kind of 90s things, right? I mean, the word Sub Pop on number 14, that pops right out. That's the Sub Pop label. I mean, that was such a big role in the grunge era, right?
Yeah, except Low is almost the exact opposite of grunge.
Right,
it's this wonderful Mormon band from upstate Minnesota that's quiet and gentle and beautiful. Slowcore is the name they use, yeah.
Right. And then, you know, Richard Thompson is jumping off this list. Wilco, Los Lobos, like all these different, you know, different artists that some of whom we haven't really seen for a while or seen lately. But, you know, what I really kind of struggle with is I feel like there's the music that you associate with your coming of age era. But then after that, like here in Gen X, looking at all the new music and how do you even discover new music? I mean, I think there's a lot of tools, but sometimes they're a bit overwhelming. How can you kind of keep your pulse on that?
Well, you know, Amy, so I teach reviewing the arts at Columbia College, and it's the same thing I say to my students all the time. You know, and it's the same thing I say to you as a great journalist and columnist, right? Nobody knows everything. well, maybe Rick Kogan, but that's about it, right? Nobody knows everything. It's like when you're a Cub reporter and you're covering, you know, City Hall in Gary, Indiana, or in my case, Hoboken, New Jersey. Four floors of City Hall. You start in the basement with the cop shop. You work your way to the top floor with the building department. You know every secretary in between, and you visit every day or twice a day. And you, you know, you chat up the secretaries, because you never get anything actually from the city clerk. It's her secretary, right?
Right.
And you bring her donuts, right? You have your antenna up all the time. And, you know, feedback and input comes to you from all the things that you read on the net, all the blogs you follow, all the fanzines, all the music magazines, you know, college radio or Chirp, you know, Chicago Independent Radio Project, right? You know, and word of mouth. You know, when two or three people have said to you, hey, have you heard Low Cut Connie, right? And then you say, okay, I got to check this out. So, you know, I used to have this conversation with Roger Ebert all the time. You know, we were colleagues at the Sun-Times for 15 years. You know, it's in the movie world, there's something like 600 major releases, you know, and that includes like the Cannes Film Festival kind of stuff, right? You know, and he figured he would see about 450 of them, right? You know, in the music world, there's like 10,000 albums released a year. And it would be impossible to take in all of them. But it's really hard to put out a record, you know, as good as any of the ones on my list, whether it's a heritage artist like Richard Thompson or somebody nobody's, you know, few people have heard of like Torres, and for it not to make a splash somewhere and many places. And then you go and you investigate. So, you know, I have no doubt there's another 300 great records that I missed, but this is the best of what I heard and took in out of the hundreds that I liked.
All right, so Jim, can we keep you on the phone for a little bit? We're going to break for news, but I want to keep talking music with you. Is that cool?
Yeah, sure.
All right.
Anytime.
Jim DeRogatis is on the phone. James Van Alstel, that's me. That Amy Guth over there. We're going to take a quick break and return with the news on WGN.
WGN. Hey, I'm Amy Guth. James Van Alstel and I are here in for Bill and Wendy, hanging with you till 3 o'clock.
And on the phone is Jim DeRogatis, rock critic, author, co-host of the syndicated show Sound Opinions, which I have history with. And Jim, we were talking a little bit about your top 40 of 2015. It's the end of the year. This is the time of year when we look back. I know Wilco made number 11 on your list. Does Wilco automatically get a pass on most rock critics' lists? Like, do they even listen?
No. If you, well, not mine, anyway. I can't talk for most rock critics. If you ask Jeff, he would have a long list of the grievances of when I was harsh on them.
But
this was a good record this year. He came back reinvigorated. I think his wife battling cancer and the time off he took from the band, making music with his son, you know, really reinvigorated him when he came back to the group.
And you have to give the band credit for naming their album Star Wars. I thought that was courageous.
Yeah, I know. Is there a movie or something out about that?
Can't hear enough about it.
Yeah, oh my God. I got a great story about number two, Low Cut Connie.
Tell us.
This fantastic band from Philadelphia.
President Obama likes them.
Well, that was the story.
Oh, sorry.
And it was a thanks, James, for ruining. Yeah,
way to go.
I'll be a guest on your show. You know, actually, if you recall Pete Souza, who was one of the great photographers at the Tribune for a long time, he left to take a little job at the White House as White House staff photographer, and he turned Obama on to Low Cut Connie, and the president put them on his own top. See, everybody does the top 10, even the president of the United States. You know, he's battling, you know, all these problems in the whole universe, global meltdown and ISIS, and he's got time to listen to tunes. But, you know, this is a great, you know, you know the great rock writer Nick Tosh's, that kind of 50s gangster barroom R&B, swagger, soul, sex, Jerry Lee Lewis lives. These guys actually tour with their own upright piano in the van and haul it out for every show. And so it's kind of building on a 50s kind of rock thing that we haven't heard in a long time, but with a very modern and sort of funny gangster kind of, you know, tough guy. It's like a Scorsese movie set to music.
That's amazing. While we have you on the phone, one story you've been following is this issue with Jam Productions.
Yes, the labor dispute.
Mm-hmm. Right. And this is still ongoing, yes?
Yes, yes. Well, you know, Jerry Michelson is fighting efforts. Well, he fired the entire backstage crew at the Riviera Theater. They were trying to unionize. So were the people at the Park West and the Vic Theater. Those are the three mid-sized venues that Jam owns. And, you know, the backstory and the bigger picture is sort of sad. I think out of stubbornness, Jerry Michelson, one of the two co-founders of Jam, is fighting this. You know, and it's hard because many of those people are well-known to the rock community. You know, you've gone to shows for years. You've seen these people working hard, you know, 12, 14-hour days from when the equipment arrives to when it leaves, you know. And, you know, they're in this life-and-death battle with the big corporate powers that be, Live Nation, C3, the folks who bring us Lollapalooza and run Nordly Island, have merged, you know. And you know, Jam is getting a real bad PR black eye here as being anti-union, which they have been, which is pretty bad. Part of the argument is that, you know, smaller companies can't pay the bigger freight of these giant corporations. So, you know, partly it's Walmart versus the mom and pop, mm-hmm. but it's a bad move, and good people have been put out of work.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, the thing that's so awesome about Chicago is like, we do have these, you know, the big venues and they have their issues and all that. But we also have all these wonderful smaller venues, and I feel like you can find two or three bands playing every single night of the week here, which is so great. But what about live music this year? What have been some highlights of some live bands, maybe local up and coming bands too?
Well, you know, I would say we do have a great community of live music here. It's always struggling. You know, it's the Lollapaloozas and the Nordly Island concerts and the corporate rock shows that get a lot of you know, support from the city. And as always, the underground community, you know, I freed of having to review Britney Spears ever again for the Sun Times. You know, most of the great music I see now is in the smaller clubs, you know, so just dives and you know, going in the Empty Bottle and, you know, a lot of the punk shows that MP Productions does. It's mm-hmm. It's liberating in that way. I have the freedom of an alternative weekly critic now, as opposed to the daily critic that has to care about Taylor Swift.
So looking back, though, on 2015, were there things that stood out to you that had you leaving the venue saying, oh, wow, that was transcendent?
Yeah, I'll tell you a great local band that I don't think gets nearly its due. Hot Lips Messiah is this wonderful female-fronted sort of garage punk, just nasty but tuneful band. And I saw them twice this year for various reasons, you know, being in the club when they were on stage. And I love that group. I think that's great. Another of my favorites for the last couple of years played its final show this year, the Kathy Santonis, named for the bad girl on Full House, the TV series.
Amazing.
They were an all-woman band, and they, you know, I mean, one of them has their PhD now and works at the Natural History Museum, you know, and it was kind of time to grow up. But it's a shame, you know, the meat and potatoes of Chicago continues to be the local bands that play here 365. It's not Lollapalooza, which occupies 3 days, you know?
Yeah.
So do you stay away from the festivals altogether? Like, did you go to Riot Fest?
No, I'm anti-fest. You know, you're either getting doused in the mud and the rain and suffering bad sound and horrible sight lines, or you're broiling in the sun. And, you know, I greatly prefer South by Southwest, where I get to see, you know, 60 or 70 bands in the space of 5 days. And it's such a better model because it builds on the existing infrastructure of Austin, taking over, you know, 40, 50 clubs throughout the city. And, you know, these clubs present music all the time. And so the sound is better. You know, the surroundings are better. You know, you're not standing in a muddy or dusty softball field.
Right. So year ahead, as we step into 2016, who has an album coming out? Who's going on tour? Who's doing stuff that you're excited about for the year ahead?
Well, one of my favorite records of the last decade is this band fronted by a French woman with three English musicians called Savages. And their debut album just blew me away. I first heard them at South by Southwest a couple of years ago. And the new album's coming out in February, and I've already heard that. And it's just, it's amazing. So I'm excited about that, you know. And, you know, I just, you know, it's always like the best band in the universe he's probably rehearsing right now in some dank, horrible basement without heat in Pilsen.
Right.
You know, and we haven't heard him yet, and we will tomorrow, and that's, you know, this hunger, this notion that you were saying it before, Amy, you know, we know the music we grew up with, and that's, you know, a lot of people stop listening. That always makes me sad, because if you look at the crowd at Star Wars at a showing this afternoon, right, it's fathers, sons, grandfathers, grandmothers, and, you know, granddaughters, right? You know, and you know, food is so huge in Chicago right now. It's like the food critics and people who love adventurous dining never say, well, you know, I ate at Avec, I don't never have to eat again. Right? So whether people say, well, you know, I heard the Beatles or I heard Nirvana, why do I need new music? Nothing's as good. It's like, oh, my God. Please, no.
I think to Amy's question earlier, though, it's hard.
It is hard.
It takes
a little effort, you know, but so does it to go out to eat and, you know, and not just the same favorite three places or, you know, to go to the movies and to see, you know, not Star Wars, but Spotlight, you know, or a greater small film, you know.
I saw the Mortgage movie. That was my anti-Star Wars move.
Okay. All right. Well, yeah, I know you're the super geek Star Wars guy. That's okay.
I'm totally not. I'm totally not.
You know, you went
not.
In costume, JP.
I am totally
James,
not.
You're a geek. You are a geek, James.
I am, but Star Wars isn't my thing.
I mean that as a compliment.
I will see you at the next Marvel movie, but Star Wars is not my thing.
No, all right. Okay.
I was excited about
Marvel's
the...
Marvel's almost as bad, you know.
Oh, how dare you.
But I'm, you know, I'm all about the Walking Dead, so...
Yeah,
what do I know?
There you go.
Which started as a comic book. All right, Jim Irigatis, Sound Opinions. We can hear you across the country on Sound Opinions with the aforementioned Greg Kot.
Yeah, and you know, I write still like not like the Sun-Times stuff that I'm interested in for WBEZ.org. So I had my whole 40 favorite albums list up there.
Fabulous. And your books are available on Amazon, and they're awesome. And if we were younger, we'd go learn from you at Columbia College.
Oh, there you go.
Jim, you're a mensch, and always a delight talking to you.
Yeah, you guys have a great day.
Thanks, Jim. See ya.
Take care.
Jim DeRogatis.
He's the best. He always brings such good information. Thank you for saying that, because I'm in agreement. It is hard to find new music.
Well, as you become an adult and move farther along in life...
And you like what you like.
There are distractions along the way. Yeah. It's hard to chase down every music blog. And if you stumble across something like Pitchfork, it seems like it's written in Aramaic, and you can't quite figure out what to extract from it.
Well, and I think less people are listening to the radio, and I think that's where a lot of us got our music for a long time, is you'd hear something on the radio and go, what is that? I have to hear that. And then the mixtape. I feel like so many people learn so much about music from mixtapes that we made for each other, and we don't really do that.
It's just not the same on Spotify.
Would someone please make me a Spotify playlist?
Really?
Make me? I don't know.
How about I burn you a CD?
I don't have a CD player. I have no way to listen to it.
In your computer? Don't you have a drive?
No, I don't. I don't. That's not a thing
I don't
anymore.
Understand anything anymore. All right. Speaking of music, which we have been doing, Corey Glover from Living Color will be joining us next on WGN.
720 WGN, Amy Guth and James Van Azel in for Bill and Wendy today, hanging out. We've been talking about year-end stuff, particularly music, the best albums of the year, things like that. And that led to a little sidebar discussion, as we are wont to do, about where we discover music. And I think that
it is hard.
It is so hard. I mean, my jam, right? I really, really got into music kind of right before the grunge era. But I grew up in a musical house. My parents met in a band, for crying out loud. So there's always music around me. But that I have such good memories around, you know, the late 80s, early 90s. Era of music when Lollapalooza started. I was at the first several of them, and it was really fun. And that's just music that I love. And even to this day, when I hear it, I get very excited. I mean, I remember exactly where I was the first time I heard Smells Like Teen Spirit by Nirvana, and it was very exciting. And I was like, what is this song? This is a totally different sound that I've ever heard before. And yet I still love music, and I find that it's really difficult to keep finding new music. And so I hear people mention, oh, so-and-so band is in town. And I'm like, who?
Well,
I'm sorry,
what? It is quite different. I mean, when I was a kid, I would go to the record store and I would spend hours. I mean, this is me as like a 12-year-old, 13-year-old. I would spend hours going up and down the aisle, just thumbing through records, looking at covers, and you know, maybe hearing something at the store playing, and that would inspire me. You know, record stores are fewer and further between these days.
And it was, in my case, it was always, I think it was like Wednesday afternoon is when the new releases came in. And there was a bin of them, and you could kind of check them out and see what they were. And there was even like a little listening area. I remember in the one that I went to, it said no air guitaring because they had little headphones.
Amazing.
And you could just kind of listen, but they didn't want you to air guitar as you were rocking out to things. But it's really different. I mean, Spotify and you know, Pandora's got that radio feature, and I like, I mean, sometimes if I am listening to a song I like on Spotify, I'll hit radio just to see what it comes up with next. But it's usually songs I already know. It rarely will take me into something new based on genre.
This drives me crazy. Okay, speaking of music discovery, none of the streaming services, Spotify, Google Play Music, do, I think, a particularly good job of recommending other music. The recommendation engines just aren't deep enough or interesting enough.
I think Spotify's Discover Weekly is pretty awesome in that regard. They take, like, based on what you've played already, like, you know, throughout your entire history with Spotify, they'll send recommendations to you. And sometimes it's a, you know, they strike out completely. But sometimes, I mean, I've discovered a good handful of bands from it.
Yeah, that's fair. But sometimes they put super weird things on there.
Sure.
You're like,
sure.
I discovered that in 1982. Thanks. I mean, the other day they put Take On Me by A-ha on mine, a couple weeks ago. And I was like, yeah, I know that one. I know that one. It's on my Big Hair and Lace Gloves playlist. Thanks. We're good.
Is that really what it's called?
Yeah, I always name all my Spotify playlists. So I have Big Hair and Lace Gloves. I have Doc Martens and Clove Smokes. That's my 90s one. I have all the good. I think Cowgirl Boots and Tattoos is my like cool country rockabilly one.
Nice.
Yeah, I always name them.
My point, I just think it's very, Google Play completely misses the mark.
Yeah, agreed.
And the tricky thing with those services is if you don't really have something in mind, it's hard to, I find myself just going back to the same stuff because the recommendation engine isn't pushing me into new directions. I just keep defaulting back to that stuff I'm familiar
what
with.
What I find myself doing a lot on Spotify, there's that little right-hand column, if you're looking at the web version of it, where it's the people that you follow, it shows what they're playing. There's people that I trust their musical tastes, and I'll see a song and go, oh, so-and-so's listening to that. I bet it's probably pretty okay, and I'll click on the song. And that's, I mean, I find a lot of new music that way, but it still doesn't feel like enough. It doesn't seem like the volume at which I consumed music once upon a time when I would hear things on the radio. My local radio station in the market where I grew up even had a like Sunday night new music thing where they would kind of debut new stuff.
Right. I've hosted some of those shows.
I'm sure.
That's when the people who run radio don't actually listen to the radio station. They think, well, we know we probably should do something like this, but let's put it on when no one
is listening.
Yeah. It's that fringe radio stuff.
Yeah.
Speaking of music and how powerful nostalgia is, I went to see Daddy's Home this weekend.
As you do.
Don't judge.
I'm judging a little bit.
Can't resist Will Ferrell. but I went to see the movie, and before the movie, there was a teaser along with the trailers that just played a live version of Welcome to the Jungle.
Wah.
Lots of crowd shots, and that's all it was.
What were they promoting?
Don't know.
just random Guns N' Roses?
We've been hearing for a while that a Guns N' Roses reunion is likely or imminent. I'm guessing this is the next step. The Guns N' Roses website's been updated. So
updated or it now exists?
I think it's been updated.
Okay.
That concert tour, if and when it happens, will print money.
Oh,
I can't imagine.
Totally.
I mean, there is an entire generation, if not two, that had never got the chance to see the band the first time around. I can't imagine what kind of ticket prices that'll command and how quickly those shows will sell out if you put Axl and Slash on stage together.
Absolutely. And who in the world would open for them? Who would be the ideal opening band if for a Guns N' Roses reunion tour?
I'm over opening bands. I don't know.
I'm not over. I'm not. I like the opening. The weirdest mashup I ever saw of opening bands, I saw U2 in the, I guess it was like the Zoo TV tour, and Public Enemy and Sugar Cubes opened for them.
I remember that.
What a completely weird lineup. In fact, I remember I worked my way down to really, really good seats. I started with nosebleed and kept like moving forward.
Because you're Amy Guth.
Also. Because that's what I do. But Public Enemy played and a bunch of people left. So everybody scooted forward. Sugar Cubes played, bunch of people left. Everyone scooted forward.
Wait, Public Enemy was first in that lineup?
Yes.
And they were at the peak of their power then.
Absolutely. And nobody really knew much about Sugar Cubes yet at that point.
And they were just a weird band.
They're still, I mean, she is still the woman who wore a goose dress to the Grammys.
Yeah, her music's always been several steps out there. I saw her at Civic Opera House years ago, and it was one of the weirdest and most wonderful things ever.
Best concert you've ever seen, go.
Iggy Pop. Easy. Metro.
Oh, man. Oh, my God. At Metro, I bet that was awesome.
1988, during a heat wave.
Wow. I bet that was a pretty good show.
Sold out, wall to wall. It was amazing. How about you?
I think the first Lollapalooza was really awesome and memorable because we hadn't really seen anything like it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I'd say that was really fun, but surprisingly, I went to a Peter Gabriel show very last minute. My friend had a ticket. Somebody bailed on him and he was like, hey, come with. And I went and it was a really good seat kind of right down front. And I was really taken by how theatrical Peter Gabriel is. And he did a lot of really cool stuff. At one point, vines came down from the ceiling and he's like on a gondola and pulling himself through a swamp or something as his like kind of weird bass players with him. And he did a lot of very theatrical stuff. So it kind of transcended the music and it was just about this almost Cirque du Soleil quality of weird little show.
Oh yeah. He's always been over the top. I think he's great. I can still listen to that Security album.
Yeah.
Over and over. I think that is tremendous.
Speaking of albums. So that's kind of a lost art, right? Not many people sit down and listen to a whole album.
Well, that's another thing I wanted to mention with Jim. We just didn't have time. You know, as you look at a top 40 list or a best of list, the album, that idea of a collection of 10 to 12 songs is becoming somewhat
changed.
Anachronistic. Yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely changed big time because people just pick out the song they like.
Well, and artists have the liberty of just putting singles out there now.
Mm-hmm.
They don't need to wait to amass them into an entire collection.
And there's an art to the order of that album and how, you know, the journey mm-hmm. it takes you through. So one that I listened to recently, start to finish, that I had not done in a long time that was so good and still stands up is The Cure's Disintegration album.
It's a great album.
So good. I thought of it because my neighbors have this wind chime that sounds like the wind chimes at the beginning of Plainsong at the very top of that album. And I was like, oh my gosh, that's exactly that noise. And I went and put the album on and I just sat there and listened to the whole thing. And I find myself doing that so rarely.
Do you have an Amy Guth goth playlist?
Yes.
What's it called?
I was totally goth. I don't remember what that one's called, or maybe I can't say it on the air. I'll have to look on the break and see what it's called. So it was a good one. It was a fun one.
So as we look back on 2015, food is such a thing here. And our next guest at 2 o'clock, Mike Gebert, he knows the ins and outs of Chicago.
You know that
dining.
Guy, Thrillist and The Reader,
and,
Fooditor.
Fooditor.com. He knows the ins and outs of Chicago food. He's got all the historical background. He has a freaky amount of knowledge of the Chicago food business.
And we're going to exploit that knowledge. It's going to be good.
Yeah. And at some point, we may even check in with Living Color.
Yeah, you know, they're busy doing stuff.
They're a rock band. They've won Grammys.
He's got complicated hair and really awesome hair.
He's cut it down a bit.
Yeah, he has.
Mike Gebert's coming up at 2 o'clock, and we'll look back. Number here is 312-981-7200.
Good times. So yeah. It's all about the inventory of the year. That's what we're all about
this show. We're taking stock because, again, everyone's phoning it in this time of year.
Not us. We're on it. We're on it.
We're here
not
for you. As you're just kind of Facebooking at work and just trying to connect 8:30 a.m. till 5 p.m., we're here for you.
You know what? And people are, you're exactly right. I've seen so much activity on Facebook and Twitter just the last couple of days of people just kind of, and then today, this morning, a huge explosion of it because everyone was expected back at work, but was kind of like, I don't want to do anything. The weather's bad.
It's the week between. I'm checked out.
Yeah, they weren't.
Good night, nurse.
Don't say I'm checked out. You're not checked out. I'm putting myself.
Yeah.
I know, but I would hate for someone to think you're checked out.
No,
when
I'm
you
not checked
clearly
out.
Are quite engaged in this conversation. Clearly.
I'm in this.
You're all up in it. Uh-huh. All right. We're going to take a little break. And as you said, when we come back, we are talking with Mike Gebert all about food in Chicago and all of that good stuff here on 720 WGN. Mm-hmm. 720 WGN, Amy Guth and James Van Osdall in for Bill and Wendy today. Thrilled to be with you. Thanks for being with us.
There's one thing we for sure love, something we for sure agree on. It's food.
Pretty much. Oh, yeah.
And we're taking some time today to look back on 2015. And we want to look back on the year in food.
In deliciousness.
In Chicago restaurants. And so I invited really the only guy I could think of who could perfectly fit the bill, Mike Gebert. He is the creator and man who runs Fooditor.com. You've probably read his stuff on Thrillist, The Reader, and other places. He's a food guy. Welcome, Mike.
Well, thank you.
Let's look back on the year in food. When you think about Chicago dining in 2015.
How would you characterize the year?
You know, the biggest thing by far was that steakhouses just exploded like crazy. Everybody was talking about steak. It seemed like a new one, the size of the, you know, the dining room on a Carnival cruise line, opened every other week in the city. You know, you can't.
Who were some of the biggies in that category?
You know, Swift and Sons in the West Loop, Maple and Ash, which is up in the Rush Street area. They just popped up everywhere.
And is this a sign the economy is doing okay? Because it seems like of all the restaurants to open, that's one that says, I'm confident that people are going to be willing to spend that kind of money.
In groups of 12 at a time, I think, especially. Yeah, it's it just proves that there's you never exhaust the business lunch and business dinner traffic that's out there. There's always a new place. And I think one of the things about it is that, you know, unlike weird foodies like me who try things everywhere, you know, the steak guys want steakhouses. They want a new steakhouse. And to give them a new steakhouse, someone has to spend $5 or $10 million to build one. And we're just seeing, you know, like pent up demand for more places to have the exact same meal, you know, or popping up all over town.
And it's not like Chicago was suffering for steakhouses.
Yeah, you know, we never had that before here until these, you know, $10 million or $100 million worth of them were built in the last few years.
So, what other trends come to mind?
You know, that's where all the money seemed to flow, and I don't think people were building fine dining, fancy schmancy places. You know, there weren't new Alinea's this year at the same level of investment. What was really kind of cool to me was a lot of chefs, a lot of small groups open kind of modest places, even modest steakhouses. I mean, there's one in, I guess you'd say Ukrainian Village is where it is, Boeuf House. Mm-hmm. It's a small place. You know, it's like a neighborhood steakhouse, which used to be a thing here. I mean, I remember places in my neighborhood, they were kind of like Wisconsin supper clubs on Ashland, basically. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that used to be a category, and I feel like downtown sucked up all that business at one point, but that's kind of coming back. Boeuf House was a good example of that, and I know a lot of critics really liked it. And, you know, just the idea that you weren't in this cavernous, you know, Union Station-sized restaurant was kind of a good thing. I know the guys who have Fork up in Lincoln Square, they're opening one, too, and there's probably others in the works. Beyond that, I mean, just a lot of other kinds of modest places. I kind of think, like, if you had to pick one restaurant that really kind of represents this year, it'd be the Duck Inn down in Bridgeport. First of all, just the fact that it's in Bridgeport is kind of revealing. I mean, people are going beyond the two or three hot neighborhoods and opening on the south side.
Someone had to plant a flag there and start something.
Yeah, yeah. You know, that I would go back maybe to... I don't know if you've ever been to a place called Pleasant House Bakery. They make, like, English meat pies and things like that. And they're really nicely done.
It's you had just, me at meat pie.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's just, it's like the perfect $8 lunch in this city in a lot of ways. And that opened right next to Maria's, the old dive bar on 31st, I guess it is. And that sort of kicked off Bridgeport as seeming a little hip suddenly, which it was. That was the furthest thing from its mind for most of the 20th mm-hmm. century, I'd say.
For sure.
But, you know, after that, people started looking at those kind of areas. They're close to downtown. It was just kind of a phobia about the South Side that I think kept a lot of development from happening in those areas. And now Bridgeport's hot. You know, Pilsen is hot.
Pilsen's definitely hot, yeah.
You know, there's a ton of activity in Chinatown that's really kind of getting away from the, you know, mom and pop Chinese place that has the Zodiac menus and, you know, things like that.
I love those. I'm a rooster.
Yeah.
It's really all about the poorly translated directions on the chopstick package. Mm-hmm. Those are always the best ones.
I just like the people who try to use the chopsticks and are completely ineffective.
Yeah, they just end up stabbing.
I have no shame. I ask for a fork and knife. It's what I know.
Do what you know. Mm-hmm. Well, and Chinatown is interesting too because I think it was about this time last year where we saw suddenly a lot of closings. Some of them from maybe some FBI issues that somebody, some tax issues that happened, right? And so we suddenly saw some kind of staples of Chinatown quickly and quietly go away, or I think people hoped quietly, but not so quietly, right? In fact, they were news. And so it's interesting that that's kind of that we're seeing some filling in happening and some growth as a result of those absences.
Well, I think another thing too is you've got the kids starting restaurants down there. You know, their parents opened what they imagined Americans imagined a Chinese restaurant to be. But the kids grew up in America, or they grew up in countries like Korea that, you know, are fairly westernized from a pop culture standpoint. And they're not looking to open, you know, the Mugu Gai Pan joint. They're looking to open a, you know, like a street food place. I mean, street food has been a big buzzword, not always very true for in Asian and other foods in Chicago.
Well, but I see street food all over, that term everywhere, and I'm not quite sure I know what it means.
Yeah, I think it really depends on the culture. I mean, like Mexican food, it's practically all street food. I mean, the tacos and things like that that you typically find in a Mexican restaurant here are found on the streets of every, you know, every city with more than four people in it in Mexico. It's a little different when it comes to Asian food. There are certain kinds of things that are cooked in street markets, which are very popular there. And street food has just kind of become shorthand for we're not serving the usual entree, but it, you know, whether or, you know, how authentic anything that says street food is an open question. Nevertheless, I mean, particularly in Chinatown, you're seeing a lot of these things coming in. You're seeing ramen shops open. You're seeing like Korean chicken wings places.
I don't get the ramen explosion. It's a bowl of broth that makes me feel like an animal when I eat it because it's so disgusting to eat.
You're supposed to, the slurp is good manners. But it was a ramen explosion year. And no, I think it's fair because there is some, people have very strong opinions about where the good ramen can be found in town. And you know what? I'll give it to them because there is a difference between a mediocre bowl of ramen and a really good one that has a lot. Because it's not a quick food. It takes hours and days to make a good bowl of ramen.
Yeah, some of the places like Furious Spoon, you know, it's like 36 hours of making this stock, which then kind of raises the question, too, are they making it like they make in Japan, or are they making it like a French chef would make it? I think sometimes they're kind of using those kinds of techniques more than they're really doing what you'd have on the street in Japan. But yeah, it's taken off. It's something to eat when deep dish pizza sounds too light for you. And, you know, so all those kinds of foods. There's a dumpling place down in Chinatown called, I think, like King Shang Yuan or something like that. That just, it went from like a little stall in a food court to just opening into a full-fledged restaurant. And that, to me, is a good example of street food. It's something that obviously is kind of portable and easy to eat. Although Asians eat street foods that are completely impractical, it seems to me. There's an Indian dish called belpuri it's basically like if you made a salad to eat walking down the street. You have to arrange eight different things.
Nope, too much work.
Yeah, eight different things in your bowl and then walk down the street poking at a salad as you're crowding on the sidewalk. Makes no sense to me, but...
All right, Mike Gebert is here. He is the man behind Fooditor.com. He's a food writer. He's a all-around good guy, and we'll have more from him next. James Van Alstel with Amy Guth on WGN.
720 WGN, Amy Guth and James Van Alstel in for Bill and Wendy today.
And in the studio, Mike Gebert from Fooditor.com. We're looking back on the year in food dining in Chicago 2015, and we were talking about how steakhouses had a big resurgence this year. Street food became a thing. Semi-upscale Mexican food was also a trend you observed.
Yeah, I think this is one of the things that's really interesting about the whole scene kind of moving toward the middle. We suddenly had, and it really didn't even start until August, but we have like five or six places that a lot of times they're cooks who worked for Rick Bayless at Frontera Grill or Topolo Bampo, you know, making his sort of upscale Asian food, Mexican food, and it all blurs together after a certain point. Mexican food, and then went out and opened their own places. And there you see that the technique is finer than the people who are slinging tacos. Not that there's anything wrong with that. But at the same time, it's still really approachable food. The prices are not high. They all have that kind of brightly colored Mexican good time feel that is really, really helpful to Chicagoans getting through a day like this. So, yeah, I mean, there are four or five places that opened like that. Ixcateco Grill up in Albany Park. I mean, that's another thing that a restaurant gets a lot of attention in. For opening in Albany Park, that doesn't happen. But maybe that's going to be another hot restaurant neighborhood.
There's no space left in Logan Square.
Right.
There's no room left to build.
Well, it's interesting, too. I was talking with some friends about, you know, did anything open in Logan Square that anybody loved? And it's funny. I mean, half a dozen restaurants opened, but I don't know that the next great thing opened in Logan Square, which is supposed to be, if you read magazines from out of town, where everything is happening in Chicago. And again, I just think that's really healthy if you're seeing places like Bridgeport and Albany Park and, you know, name half the neighborhoods in the city.
Well, even in the last couple of years, we've seen things happening in Humboldt Park, which was absolutely, you would not hear about a restaurant opening or a bar, much less a craft cocktail or something like that coming out of Humboldt, which we are now.
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
places like and, yeah,
Parsons and things like that. Yeah, they're all moving into these neighborhoods. And usually with food that, I mean, it's higher than going to a fast food place, but it's not outrageously expensive. It's within the affordability of, you know, the majority of Chicagoans, I think.
So what other places would you put under the kind of this explosion of upscale Mexican food?
Well, I just went to one yesterday down in Pilsen called Five Rabanitas, which apparently means the five little radishes. That's what the chef and his four brothers were when they sold radishes in Guerrero, where they came from.
Oh, right.
But he worked for Rick Bayless, worked at Shoko and Topolobampo, and then opened his own place. It was really nice. I mean, nicely made moles on tamales and things like that. So it's not just a taco place, although they have tacos. But that was a really nice one. Latinicity is the one in the Loop, which hasn't gotten the greatest.
At Block 37.
In Block 37. I actually think, you know, if you're smart about what you pick there and try not to be a stupid American ordering a hamburguesa in a Mexican place, there's actually some pretty good things there.
But you struck on something right there. It is really hard to find decent food in the Loop. In Chicago, I find dining choices, particularly for lunch, kind of challenging outside of the chains.
Yeah, I mean, I ate 10,000 meals at Wall Street Deli that I would love to give back from the 90s. It's just, I don't know why. I mean, obviously the real estate favors chains to some extent, and so you get a lot of chains there. But it just, you know, it's never, maybe after a certain point, poor choices reinforce not very picky diners and vice versa.
And immediate need. I got to find something quick. Get in, get
out. I got to grab it. Go back to my desk.
Uh-huh. Not,
you know.
Phone it in. Facebook for a while.
Do all of those things that people do in the workplace.
Exactly. And, you know, you're talking about how big of a Mexican food city Chicago is, which it totally is.
But it isn't. I'm from Texas, and I'm here to tell you that I cannot get my fix here. It's very, very difficult. I can get... There's some little hole-in-the-wall taquerias I can go to and kind of get my fix, but it's very hard to get, like, the Tex-Mex anyway. Like,
yeah,
that kind of... There's not...
I think the big difference there is that in Texas and... Texas and Mexico flow into each other easily. People go back and forth, and you get that sort of cuisine from the border there. We get people from much deeper in Mexico who come here and move here. So... Our food comes from like Guerrero, it comes from Mexico City and stuff like that. And it just doesn't really resemble Tex-Mex, which really is a fusion of American and Mexican food. So I can see why you feel like, you know, why isn't anything like Matt's El Rancho here?
Right. Not like, or even into like northern New Mexican cuisine, right? That has like the red and green chile or Christmas. If anyone knows about like Santa Fe dining, they know what Christmas means because it means you want both red and green chile sauce on top of your stuff.
Right.
Not a thing here.
Craft beer. It seems like that trend or that level of enthusiasm is in no way going to die out soon. I mean, is that trend going to, is it still on the upward trajectory?
I was talking with some beer guys about whether we're going to start basically having neighborhood beers. You know, we've got a brewery.
Hyper-local beer.
Yeah, a brewery in
apartment
every
10
neighborhood.
Lager.
Right.
Right. And it really feels like that. I mean, there's the opening of that has just been so extensive. And to me, I mean, I've was a home brewer for a while and all that, but still it's kind of all beer. I don't know. Maybe it's just my palate, you know, can tell two pizzas from different parts of the city apart, but not beers with nearly that much.
And because a lot of people will judge bars, even restaurants, based on the beer selection now. And before it was almost a non-issue. Oh, they've got light. I'll have that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All good.
Old style. What a surprise to see that in a Chicago
bar.
But
it's almost the level of craft beer enthusiasm. It's like comic book collectors. It's like, oh, you have issue number 40? Well, I remember when I got issue number one.
I've had last year's, you should drink it now versus you should sit on it for a couple of years, you should wait. Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting.
It's super nerdy.
But at some point, where's the top of it? I mean, at some point, peak craft beer will happen, yes. And I don't know where that will be.
People will be auctioning, you know, Dark Lord for $10,000 or
right.
something.
It'll be like an eBay for beer or something.
Yeah.
But there is a collector's market.
There is, yeah. And I think, too, it's interesting how people are starting to move into, because where else are you going to go, I suppose, if the market is getting pretty saturated, into where the sourcing is coming from. Like, this is from a local grain, or this is mm-hmm. a, you know, so that the local vore thing kind of is even spilling into, and not even just beer, into craft cocktail too. I think that was a word a phrase we've heard a lot in the last year or two or so. But even we're seeing like chef-like precision going into our craft cocktails and in sourcing the ingredients and where those are from and what those are, and infusions with local products with a certain vodka or mezcal or whatever.
Yeah, there's one of the more interesting cocktail openings of the year, I think, is this place called Green River that's on top of one of the Northwestern Hospital buildings, which is an odd atmosphere to walk through to get to a bar.
Though I guess a little
bit. Probably weirder to leave after being in the bar.
Yeah, in certain cases, you're right where you need to be afterwards, I guess. But you should just like take the menu, find a nice corner, and sit and read it for a half hour, because it's all arranged by type of grain, and it goes into a couple of paragraphs on each one and each drink and all that. And you never need to actually get to the drinking part. You can just do it all by reading.
I was going
to
say, the menu sounds like a Common Core requirement. A little extensive. We got confirmation, by the way. Corey from Living Color will be checking in.
Excellent.
In a little bit.
All right.
It's exciting. All right. So, Mike Gebert, people can find you where?
Fooditor.com. That's fooditor.com.
And what's the most recent thing on your website? If people go there, what's the big headline? What's the big feature story?
The most recent piece was talking about the end of the year, just like I'm doing right
Perfect.
Now.
Well, you did an exemplary job here. And you also, I know you're also doing kind of a podcast.
Yeah, that was actually one. I got some other food writers together. We just got together in a bar, a noisy bar, and recorded our conversation, and then I cut the boring bits out.
So as someone who is podcasting, you made the conscious decision, I'm not comfortable making money, and I want to work really hard to make no money. Attaboy, I'm proud of you. Welcome aboard.
That's
Welcome
exactly
to our little club. It's a fine place.
All right, Mike Gebert, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, my friends, we're going to take a little break, and we'll be right back and get you to news here in just a bit on 720 WGN. There it is. Amy Guth and James Van Osdahl in for Bill and Wendy today here on 720 WGN.
And on the phone, we have Corey Glover, lead singer of the amazing hard rock band Living Color, a band that, well, brief breakup aside, has been killing it for three decades and going. There have been Grammys. They were on the first Lollapalooza tour. They're unafraid to address social issues. And this band makes everyone who listens to them...
And we're black. And we're black.
And you're black.
And we're black.
And that.
That stopped me in my tracks. And they're black. And they make anyone who listens to them want to learn how to play guitar. Hi, Corey.
Hey, how you doing?
Hey,
good. You guys are back in town, City Winery, on Wednesday for two shows, early and late. And seeing you at Riot Fest just a couple months ago, looking at that crowd... You're at a point now in your career where Living Color is truly cross-generational in your appeal. I mean, there were kids in the crowd. There were people my age and older.
I would say there were 40s. Those of us who were at the first few Lollapaloozas that remember you from that came back for this.
That's got to feel kind of amazing.
Well, I think people made a mistake and they were wandering and they wound up in front of us. But that's another story.
Oh, come now.
Wait, that's not No Doubt. Who is that? They're black.
Exactly. Yeah, that's not Gwen Stefani. Who the hell is that?
Yeah, you know, it's so weird. Amy and I both grew up with Living Color, and this year, 2015, is the 25th anniversary of Time's Up.
Yes.
Does that mean we're all getting old?
Unfortunately.
That album. Can we? Do we have Solace of You ready to go?
Great song.
Oh my God, that song still makes such a connection with me. That album is so fantastic.
Well, while he's looking for that, though, you know, I mean, I can't help but think as we talk about Lollapalooza and a Riot Fest. I mean, Lollapalooza was kind of, when it first started, it was sort of the first of its kind to do something like that. Like, we hadn't seen anything like that kind of since Woodstock even, right? And so now there's so much of that. There's a lot of different fests, and there's a lot of different fests in different markets and things like that. And so how would you kind of compare the two experiences of that beginning of Lollapalooza and then playing Riot Fest?
Well, you know, when we would do, when we, back in the day, when in my day, when we did Lollapalooza, it was traveling. It was going around the country. It went across North America. So we were having these festivals every other day of all these bands, which I don't think is done now. It's done very rarely. Gathering with Oz, maybe. I mean, I don't know. But it's a very rare occurrence when you can get this kind of thing to come to your town. It's usually a seminal event that you have to go to, like Coachella and Red Rocks and that kind of thing. But the bands that were there, you know, went on to become very legendary. In my opinion, Jane's Addiction obviously is still a legendary band, and Nine Inch Nails was a legendary band. Butthole Surfers were a legendary band just because of their name. And we had, you know, Henry Rollins came out of that. It was a who's who of people that came out of those first couple of Lollapaloozas. It sort of like informed the musical landscape for another 10 to 20 years.
Agreed. Now, going back even before the band did Lollapalooza, what did you learn from touring with the Stones at the end of the 80s?
Don't drink.
There's the takeaway, kids. Take that to heart. Wait, was it intense in that environment? Was it just hedonism?
It wasn't a hedonism that was interesting to us. It was just that these are people who are still doing it. You know, to us, we were still young and very sort of wide-eyed about this. And these were the grizzled veterans. And they still got up for it every night. And they still put on one hell of a show every time they got on stage. You know, I don't know if you guys remember how big that their stage was. It was half a football field long. And they would run around this whole stage that was half a football field long. And we didn't understand, like, wow, that's great. I wish I could do that when I'm their age. Joke cut to now, and I'm trying.
Right. You're succeeding. I mean,
you're succeeding.
Again, you're going to be at City Winery on Wednesday night for a pair of shows. And this city certainly loves and adores you. Thinking about Cult of Personality, when that took off, that wasn't even the first single from Vivid.
No, it wasn't. Actually, the first single was Middleman. Mm-hmm. And we kept saying to the record company, you know, maybe you should put this song out. It's like, we're going to do a slow burn. We're going to see how this goes and how that works. But put this out. We'll see. No. Put this out. And then put it out. And it took some time, but it got what they called back then phones. Mm-hmm. Like radio stations would play the song late at night. And people would call and say, what was that song?
Well, God, it's that riff. It's the sound bites. Right. It's you.
It's such a memorable song.
Right? It is. It's indelible.
I mean, it's got a bunch of stuff in it that sort of informs. It goes into a lot of different places, let's say. And it's very interesting how that sort of stands the test of time.
Well, what's interesting, Middleman was the first single. Interesting choice. That song's essentially a suicide note, isn't it?
Yeah, sort of. Yeah, it is. It's for me. It was. That's what I. It's originally I wrote it as a suicide note, and then sort of slowly realized it wasn't so bad, and might as well stick around.
As you put yourself, as you sing these songs in the present day in 2015, as you sing songs like Middleman, is it hard, or maybe not, to channel the young Corey and kind of feel the emotion you felt when you were 16 years old?
Oh yeah. Those things are still on the surface. You know, so not that, you know, I'm considering suicide anytime soon. But the angst and the anger, and I mean, what's sort of interesting and somewhat sad is that nothing has really changed in terms of the social landscape. The rich are still rich, the poor are still poor. People are still getting, you know, screwed over. It's still there. It's not, that hasn't changed. And no one song is ever going to change that. You know, there's no middleman, no cult personality, no overlord to the landlord is going to change that, which is kind of sad, but fortunate for us because that means we get to play them.
Is it wrong that I just got chills when you said open letter to a landlord?
Not wrong at all. Well, I mean, you know, I was going to ask you, though, you know, about when we think about the social and political issues that are so present in your music, you know, and kind of that evolution of how you've thought of them. And indeed, all of those social issues are still there. But has your approach to them in terms of putting them out creatively or dealing with them or confronting them creatively, has that changed?
No, not at all. I think that has to be the way we have to deal with it. I you know, I'm not a politician. You know, my activism and my social, my community is through what I do, through my music. So if I have to, if I see something, I'm going to say something, and I have to say something, or I can't be bottomed up.
As we head into an election year, I've got to ask, is humanity driving off a cliff?
I hope so, because it makes good songs.
All for a good cause.
You know, beyond the social issues and lyrics that you do, Corey, I get the sense that you, and really everyone in your band, is a lover of music. I mean, just based on where you draw from, whether it's blues or funk or rock. Mm-hmm. And I know you've been doing the jam band thing, too.
Yeah, I've been working with bands like Galactic and Lettuce, and I've been doing that for a while now.
I hear that.
My own jam band. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Now, you hear that in Living Colors music, just an appreciation for, in some cases, distinctly American sounds, like the blues.
Well, not just American sounds, because you know we draw from a lot of wells. You know, there are artists that very African, specifically. West African, Ghanaian musical influences in there. Solace of You was our attempt at doing highlife music from South Africa. So we draw from it all, wherever it comes from, as long as it's about how it expresses itself. So that's how we get it. Wow, that, what a nice segue.
Yeah, see? This song, I'm telling you, it still resonates. All right, Corey Glover of Living Color, we can see you Wednesday night, two shows at City Winery. I'm so glad you took back the breakup and kept moving forward.
Yeah, well, the breakup didn't last that long because, you know, as much as we were having, you know, a need to be apart from each other, we needed each other. It wasn't about, oh, I hate you, go away. I'll see you when I see you. It was like, I need some sleep. I need a long nap. And once we got that nap, it's like, okay, let's get back to work.
And we're glad. We're all glad.
Corey Glover of Living Color, thank you so much for checking in.
Thank you.
Thanks, Corey. Have a great show Wednesday and Thursday. Awesome at City Winery.
Both shows are Wednesday.
Both shows Wednesday. City Winery is an awesome venue. If you've not been, everybody, go check it out.
And Living Color still brings it. And this is a band that absolutely kills on stage.
Yeah, absolutely does.
All right. It's WGN, James Van Osdell and Amy Guth in for Bill and Wendy today. We'll be right back.
WGN 720. James Van Osdell and Amy Guth in for Bill and Wendy. So that was fun, talking to Corey Glover of Living Color. I can't even talk. I'm so excited that we talked to him.
He's the coolest.
Yeah.
I mean, for decades running, like end of the 80s through today, I mean, that band still just rocks.
And that's a band that a lot of people, and I know I'm including myself in this, but I think a lot of people have identified with at a lot of different points in their lives.
Oh, yeah.
Like, because they've just been around so long and they've just rocked for so long.
Yeah. And he joked about people accidentally seeing them at Riot Fest. I think they played at like 3:00.
No. It was no accident.
No. It's one of those things you see, you know, 16-year-old teenagers and you see
discovering them, but then you see,
or they're at least familiar, you know, there's at least a familiarity because of CM Punk using Cult of Personality as his entrance music for years in the WWE, but you see the adults and kids, I mean, it's just they're at that point now. You stay together long enough, have enough hits,
and you
can break those generational boundaries.
Right. I'll never forget, my dad is one of those people that can listen to an album and then just play it on the guitar. He just has that gene that I don't have.
Yeah.
And the first time he heard me listening to Smells Like Teen Spirit and that whole Nevermind album. He, like, I had it on in the car or something. He was like, what is that? And then he borrowed my CD, took it home, listened to it, and then was ready to play it. He knew every song on that album. And he didn't know what to call it. He just said, I'm digging that. I don't know what it is. And it was kind of a cool, great music just speaks to people in different ways. And it doesn't matter, you know, how old you are or what you're into. If it's great music, it's great music. Word. There you have it. I have no segue. But I have something I would like to discuss.
works. That in itself is a segue by definition.
Just call it what it is. So there's this story that I'm sure you have seen in your social feeds, because I know mine has been inundated with it.
No, my social feed is all Doctor Strange and Benedict Cumberbatch right now.
Oh, no, not mine at all. Mine is a lot of people threatening to not speak to people again if they spoil Star Wars for them. But also this story. And that is why you should buy the men's version of just about everything. It's a thing. Like everything, not underwear, not that. But
body care products, that
yes,
kind of stuff?
Razors are on this list. Lots of things are on this list. So there was this really started happening because there was a scooter that is available. It is a Radio Flyer, the maker of the ubiquitous
little red
wagon
yeah.
right? The red scooter that is available for all children.
And a scooter is just like a
it's
platform.
It's like a skateboard with a handle.
Yeah.
Little thing. It's got three wheels and a handle. And the red Radio Flyer, my first scooter sport edition, it only comes in red. That's $24.99. So $25. Nice little toy. Lots of kids would love that. And then they came out with one called Radio Flyer Girls Edition, my first scooter, sparkle pink. And it is $50.
Wait, what?
Exact same scooter, exact same manufacturer. The difference is red for all children versus the pink sparkles for girls. And they doubled the price.
I don't understand the psychology or the reason or any of that.
None whatsoever, other than we'll pay for things like that. So it launched a lot of studies and investigation, and it's a big deal. And so people have been looking at other products. So the New York City Department of Consumer Affairs first jumped on this, and then they kind of led the charge of looking at all these different products. But it's like stuff like body wash is a big one because it's scented, whatever. But there's a lot of like razors are a big one. The Schick Hydro for men.
I always wondered if there was a difference.
Well, there is, because the women's razor is much crappier.
Really?
It's really not an effective razor. Men's razors are way, way better.
Well, we do have thicker beards.
But we have more real estate to cover with said razor. Legs are more than face.
True.
Like, come on. So the Schick Hydro for the five blades for the razor refills, right? That's $15 for dudes. For women, same thing, exact same thing, except a less quality razor is $19. Again, what?
And I will say, both of those still sound cheap to me. I feel like the last time I bought a 5-pack of blades was like $22.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Blades are ridiculous.
They are, but it's not fair. So I was talking about this a little bit on the Business Lunch show on Saturday, and a writer from the Washington Post was on, and she suggested people, when they see this out in drugstores, use hashtag gender pricing. Just tweet it. Take a picture and be like, here it is. There it is. So I started looking for it. And the only time I could find the reverse, because then I started wondering, well, what are men paying more for? The only time I could find an example, there's like the Nivea lotion that's considered for anyone, but then there's like Nivea men. Because it smells manly. It smells like woods and Arctic stuff or whatever. And that one is a little bit more. It
smells like hunting and trapping.
Yeah. Right. Clubbing baby seals. Right. It's manly stuff. So, I mean, I think it's really interesting when there's a women's version of something or a men's version of it. I mean, to me, it kind of like reminds me of the way we name sports, right? Like NBA and then WNBA. So it's the sub one, as opposed to defining both as like the men's one and the women's one. We have the standard and then one gender specific for either men or women. I don't like it.
The scooter thing is mind-blowing, though. That's not a couple bucks. That's...
No, that's double the price for pink sparkles. Not okay.
Maybe those sparkles are made with silver.
Maybe. There's some damn expensive sparkles is whatever. But anyway, this story is at WashingtonPost.com. You can check it out. And they talk all about the all the things they're comparing, things like that. But the big one, preschool toys tend to be very different pricing, tend to be more expensive for girls. The average there is about $20 for boys' preschool age toys and about $22 for girls.
Okay.
Then onesies, also there's some disparity, like a boy's onesie versus a girl's, which is just going to be like different words on the tummy.
It is.
Right?
Like different characters. Yeah.
Children's underwear, adult shirts, significantly higher for women, razor cartridges, like all stuff
adult
like
shirts.
That. Adult shirts, which I would also say that carries over into the dry cleaner, because if you take a white button down, usually most dry cleaners, like there's a sign that says like dress shirts, $1.99 or something like that. But if you take a women's shirt in there and the only difference is like a dart on the side to account for the waist being nipped, that's going to be like $5 or $6 to dry cleaner.
See, I pay a lot at the dry cleaner because all my silk blouses
you're so
are
fancy.
Yeah.
Because you fancy, JVO. You fancy.
That's me.
That's what you are. That's how you are. But don't be fancy today, because it's like cruddy out there and slushy, and we have entered the slush season, and all this slush is going to freeze, and then people are going to be like slipping and sliding all over the place, which means because now it's actual winter in Chicago, I don't even want to say this word in the air because people freak out. Dibs are going to start happening.
We scarcely have the time.
I know. We can't even don't call us. Don't.
Yeah, how dare you bring that
don't
up
have
right
to,
now?
We don't even have time for dibs because I know people feel passionate.
No,
about
I'm freaking out because I know I don't have any salt at home, and I'll need to salt my wok.
Do you use like pet friendly salt?
Yeah,
that's important because their little paws
they can't take it.
No, they can't.
But I live on a corner, and you know, kids wait outside for the bus, and I want to make sure that no one.
Well, you don't want to get sued, is what.
That's kind of where I was going in a more delicate way.
Also that, but it's like winter and like streets and like winter plus streets are just a bad thing, right? Because we get into the dibs conversation. We know the potholes start as soon as those salt trucks come out.
Oh, yeah.
All the potholes start. I liked the guy. Maybe it wasn't last year. I think it was a couple of years ago. The artist that was filling potholes with mosaics.
I remember that.
I was on board. I was ready to help that guy out. He never. I don't know. I said it on the air. He didn't. He never called me. It was a thing.
Yeah. Meanwhile, I've got to walk to Union Station from here.
Oh.
And I feel like I can't take a cab.
Why?
You know, I'm only working for 2 hours today. I feel like I'm...
It's like checks and balances for the day.
Yeah, exactly.
It might be all
in
of
my
six,
personal P&L statement.
$6,
yeah.
$6 to get you to Union Station.
Maybe. But, you know, I could use the walk. I didn't eat responsibly over the past week.
Okay, well.
There may have been a lot of candy and ice cream.
Sure.
There may have been a milkshake two nights ago.
Tis the season.
There may have been Taco Bell last night.
Oh, nice.
And that's what I was going to say when Mike Gebert, the food writer, was here. We live in a town that... I believe is a very solid Mexican food town. I had Taco Bell last night. I told my friend Chris that this morning. He said, you know where we live, right? you know what's available in Chicago.
Yeah, Taco Bell is a chemical burrito.
It's fast food.
It's fast food, right.
But indeed. With all the taquerias.
And some delightful taquerias in this town.
Mm-hmm. I failed myself.
You kind of did. You kind of did. Hey, you know what? This was fun. Let's do it again tomorrow.
Tomorrow we'll be back. Who do we have lined up? We've got stuff planned, right?
We got stuff.
All right.
We're talking about things and stuff.
1 to 3 p.m.
As we do. We're going to talk about politics. We're going to talk about food. We're going to talk about all kind of fun stuff.
And maybe some music, too.
Maybe some music. As we are wont to do.
Uh-huh.
Well, let's take a break and turn it over.
Cool.
All right. This is 720 WGN.